Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
Hi there, Phyllis. This is Meghna Chakrabarty and On Point. Thanks for being with me today. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm okay. Thank you.
Okay. Well, this is Phyllis Levin-Augustino. She's a listener in Highland Park, Illinois, and she called us when we asked everyone this question earlier this week. We asked everyone, are you happy? And so, Phyllis, are you happy?
Well, you know, it really depends. I do have a problem with that word. So I'm okay, but happy is not a word I would use.
Okay, so what does okay then mean for you? Describe your okayness.
Okay. Okay means I'm doing what I need to do. I'm taking care of myself. Number one is being safe and healthy. And I'm doing things that I feel good about. I like to do artwork. I like to be outdoors, those kinds of things. So I'm kind of trying to take care of myself. I'm trying to relate to the world and be helpful and conscious and those things. It's a lot of things. Some days are like survival days. Mm-hmm. And other days it's like, oh, that was good. So it's a lot of things. Mm. I think my life felt like it was erased in a day. I lost my job. Uh-huh. I lost my full-time job. And it's like, oh, my. And I'm over 70, so that's not a good situation. And I wasn't financially prepared to retire.
When did that happen?
Last year, around, end of March.
Oh, okay. So at the same time that so many others lost their jobs too. Okay. And you haven't been able to find work since then?
No, I do a little bit of part-time work, but very little, and I'm trying to stay safe. So, yeah.
So I heard you just now describe a lot of things. Like, mm-hmm. on some days, I can hear why you're okay engaging in things that you enjoy. But overall, there's a not okayness. Is that an accurate description?
I would say that's true. Yeah. Yeah.
So then take me back to why you don't even think the word happy is the right word to use.
Mm-hmm. I don't ask people if they're happy anymore. If I do, I get a strange look. Are you okay? Happy to me seems almost elitist and superficial. It's like, it just doesn't seem like the right word, even though the things behind it are good. I understand, the research and what we're looking for, but that word itself to me is just like a surface kind of word, mm-hmm. that doesn't get to the depth of what we're all feeling.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this, though, Phyllis. I mean, I have to say it kind of jars me a little bit to hear you say that happy sounds like an elitist thing, because, I mean, I feel like happiness should be a basic and profound experience that all humans have. And are born with the capacity of feeling. I don't even know what I'm trying to ask. I'm appreciative and a little bit taken aback by your candor here. Don't worry about it. But happiness being elitist, does that mean that you don't feel like happiness is something that you can have?
Sometimes I can have a happiness, but I don't use that word. It's more for me. I think that I feel joy, uh-huh. or I feel satisfaction, or I feel connection, or I feel worth, or lots of other things that to me seem deeper than this word
okay.
called happiness.
Okay. So
these are post-pandemic times. I can't ignore what's going on.
Yeah, I know. I totally hear you. I mean, that's why we wanted to do this hour today, Phyllis, because for the past 18 months, I have heard on this show and also just in my own life from people all around me who just say that, like, everything has changed so much. There has been and continues to be so much suffering that happiness doesn't feel like this state that they can achieve anymore, or that they shouldn't even try to, or, I mean, and as you just put it, like, just something that doesn't go deep enough. So Hank, can you just stick with me for a second here,
okay,
Phyllis?
Sure.
Because I want to now bring in a couple of people who can help us think through this. First of all, Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst, who's with us today again. Hello there, Jack.
Hello, Magna. Hello, Phyllis.
And Lori Santos is with us as well. She is a cognitive scientist and professor of psychology at Yale and host of the podcast The Happiness Lab. Professor Santos, welcome to you.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Okay. So I wanted to keep Phyllis with us here because she's given me a whole lot to think about. So first of all, just respond to what you heard Phyllis say, that happiness doesn't even seem like the right word to use given planet Earth in 2021.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, a lot of people feel the way you do, Phyllis, honestly. I mean, I think, you know, happiness can be a really loaded word. And I think we get a lot from the media. You know, if you do a Google image search for happiness, you see like super smiling emojis and people jumping around and things like that. And, you know, nothing in 2020, 2021 has felt like smiling emojis and jumping around. You know, that said, I kind of agree with what Meghna was saying, which is that, you know, happiness is really part of our like human nature, right? It's the kind of thing that we all can enjoy if we use the right strategies. But I think we need to be realistic about what happiness is. It's not positive emotion purely all the time and jumping around and happy emojis. Like, true happiness really comes with embracing what's going on in the world, coming to terms with negative emotions. You know, I think when you really understand what happiness is from the perspective of social science, it's not kind of Pollyanna-ishly avoiding what's going on in the world. It's really kind of embracing that and finding gratitude, finding joy anyway.
Phyllis, what do you think?
Oh, that makes total sense. And I would agree. And I still have a problem with the actual word. I agree with what she's saying. And yeah.
Well, you know, there's something you said a little bit earlier, Phyllis. I mean, first of all, about the struggles that you've already been through and are still going through financially, if I can just put it bluntly. Mm-hmm. And then also that, do you find it harder to connect with those, let's focus on the deeper things, joy, satisfaction, connection that you talked about. Is that more challenging now for you than it was in the past?
Yes and no. I have more time now. And at the beginning of the pandemic, when I wasn't so worried and I thought for 6 months, I felt like, well, just, this is a nice vacation. Look at all the time I have. And then when I started getting worried that this wasn't going to sustain me, then I have to clear away time that when I'm not worried. Because when I'm feeling worried and stressed, then it's hard for me to do the things that make me happy. And I do artwork, but I went through a period where it's like, well, I've got nothing to say. And then I sort of forced myself. I had some reason, some occasions that I wanted to do stuff, and I forced myself, and then I thought, oh, this works for me. This makes me feel good, and this helps me connect to other people.
Okay. So before I let you go, Phyllis, and I am feeling very grateful for your candor and sharing today. Is there a question that you have for Professor Santos about, you know, sort of maybe how you can get closer to, I'm going to stick with your words again, joy and satisfaction and connection?
Oh, I don't know if I have one question. Let me think for a minute. It seems like it's a matter of holding two truths at the same time, is the way I've heard it put. So there's the truth of all the suffering around us and recognizing that. And then there's the truth of our own happiness and our own well-being, and that we have to do both at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's sort of what I need to do, is to be able to do both at the same time. And that's what I was hearing Professor Santos saying.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Phyllis Levin Agostino in Highland Park, Illinois, thank you so much for joining us. And I'll let you keep listening, but we're headed towards the break here, so I wanted to be sure I said thank you before we ran out of too much time. I really appreciate it, Phyllis.
Thank you for having me.
Professor Santos, I'm going to let you respond to what Phyllis said, but I do want to hear from Jack Beattie a little bit on this, because he's been, over the past couple of days, has been talking a lot about, Jack, about how this question of happiness is reflected throughout so much of literature and your reading. So tell me a little bit, Jack, here.
Well, yes, you know, I think in general, literature has felt about the word happiness and depicting states of happiness a little the way Phyllis does, embarrassedly. Mm. In other words, most of our books are about how people screw things up, to put it bluntly. But there are books, there are writers, there are moments that give pictures of what happiness is. And one of them, one of my favorites, is from a John Cheever story, The National Pastime. Briefly, a young man asks his father to go out and play catch with him in the yard, and the father doesn't want to do it. The mother says, oh, go out and throw the ball with the boy. He goes out, he throws the ball breaks through the glove, hits the boy in the mouth, his mouth fills with blood. And thereafter, he avoids everything to do with baseball. He hides under the grandstand when they're having a game. He gets sick or looks for excuses. When he's employed as a teacher, he hits the ball. He has to participate in the game, and he goes to the third base rather than first and gets thrown out. And in general, this weight of baseball and his father's disapproval just hangs over him, and in the sequel, we'll find out how that's resolved.
Okay. Jack Beattie and Laurie Santos stand by here. We are talking about what is happiness? What is happiness in the midst of a modern life that seems full of so many reasons to counteract that happiness? We'll be back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about why, even as the world hurls so many reasons for you to not be happy, or you think it does, why you deserve to be happy. And I'm joined by Laurie Santos. She's a professor of psychology at Yale University. She teaches one of the most popular classes at Yale, and it's about happiness. She's also a cognitive scientist and host of the podcast, The Happiness Lab. And Professor Santos, I'm going to come right back to you. But Jack Beattie, On Point News Analyst, you left us hanging there with that John Cheever story about happiness. What happens?
The national pastime, as I say, a little boy plays catch with his father, the ball gets through his gloves, smashes his mouth, tastes the blood. Thereafter, he avoids baseball, phobic about it, loses a job because he runs to the wrong base, and he discovers that his father, that there was more to that throw than just met the eye. His father lost a bequest from his eccentric aunt because he had a third child. The aunt said, no, I don't want you to have any more children. He had the child, the child was our narrator, Eben. And then he discovers his father dies. His father's will, he says, to my changeling son, Eben, the author of all my misfortunes, I leave my copy of Shakespeare, a hacking cough. The list was long and wicked. Well, he gets married. He has his own life. And finally, he's got five boys, and he decides to take them to Yankee Stadium for a game. Mickey Mantle was up. And he hits a foul ball, and here's the end of the story. It was coming like a shot, but I made the catch one-handed, barehanded. And although I thought the impact had broken some bones in my hand, the pain was followed swiftly by a sense of perfect joy. The old man and the old house seemed at last to fall from the company and the places of my dreams, and I smelled the timothy and the sweet grass again, and saw a grave digger hidden behind a marble angel, and the smoky, the grainy light of a thunderstorm, when the clearness of the green world reminds us briefly of a great freedom of body and mind. Then the boys began to argue for possession of the ball, and I gave it to the oldest one, hoping that I wouldn't have any more use for it. It would have troubled my father to think that he would be buried in any place as distant from West Farm as Yankee Stadium, but that is where his bones were laid to rest.
Well, that's Jack Beattie reading John Cheever here. And Professor Santos, you know, in listening to Jack reminding us of that Cheever story, and Phyllis, who talked to us earlier from Illinois, I now want to almost reframe this entire show and just focus on, for at least a few minutes, on how we should be just defining what happiness is, that clear moment of joy that Cheever describes in that story. And then Phyllis says happiness isn't even the right word. So how would you define it?
Yeah, well, social scientists tend to define happiness in kind of two parts, right? So they tend to think of happiness as being happy in your life and being happy with your life. So being happy in your life is having these moments of joy, whether that's, you know, chatting with the barista at the coffee shop, you know, paying attention, you know, to the beautiful fall leaves outside, right? It's just these moments of true joy, positive emotion in your life. That's not to say that there's no negative emotion. It's just that if you have negative emotion, you want it kind of balanced with these moments of positivity. That's kind of being happy in your life. But there's also the sense that happiness is about being happy with your life. That's the sense of meaning you have. You know, it's the answer to the question, all things considered, how satisfied are you with your life right now? And it's worth noting that those two forms of happiness can dissociate, right? Mm. I have one of my deans, you know, had a baby recently. And, you know, I often use the example of her because, you know, I think in her life, you know, she's so happy, this new meaning that she has with this new bundle of joy. But with her life, you know, there's poopy diapers and less sleep and things like that, right? I think we all know other people who have the opposite dissociation, right? Where they have, you know, all the worldly comforts possible, you know, in their life, it's great, but they're feeling really empty with their life. And so what the social science tries to do is to figure out, okay, what are ways that we can bump up both of these? Because if we have both of these in place, I think, you know, you can say that you're living, you know, a pretty happy life.
Okay, so this helps me understand a little bit more about what we've been hearing over the past 18 months, right? Because I feel like a lot of people are experiencing that sense of dissociation between those two forms of happiness you just talked about. I mean, for example, here's Dr. Sanda Wartsky from North Carolina. And in her job, she helps find stability and happiness for other people for a living because she's a practicing psychologist. But she also told us about the impact the pandemic has had on her.
I do have to say that as a practicing psychologist and therapist, my tendency tends to be fairly positive and optimistic and encouraging. But I have to admit that during the last year and a half, pandemic has been really tough. And I have noticed that my discontentedness and just the feeling overwhelmed and mental health needs have just skyrocketed. And, you know, I'm glad to be able to be somebody who can be a part of that, but it also at times has admittedly been overwhelming.
So, Professor Santos, is that a reduction in the happiness in a person's life or the with part?
I mean, I think it's a little, maybe a little bit of both. I mean, it's worth recognizing in the context of this pandemic, right? We are not supposed to be purely happy right now, right? It would be non-normative situation where your social connections are getting messed up, you know, your routines are getting messed up. Literally, people are dying. And to just be, you know, perfectly happy-go-lucky and not experiencing any negative emotion, that would be non-normative. It is the right thing to do right now to have your happiness be affected, to experience some negative emotions. The key, though, is kind of how you take care of yourself in the midst of that, right? Do you try to avoid those emotions and run away from them? Or do you find ways to allow them? Do you beat yourself up over having them? You know, I think this was something I was hearing in a little bit of Phyllis's remarks, right? This idea that, well, you know, I'm not supposed to be happy. It's for someone else. Like, I'm doing something wrong. Like, no. We're supposed to experience negative emotion, especially if you're in a situation of unemployment or losing your job or something like that. So, I mean, I think that we forget that, you know, we're not necessarily supposed to be happy all the time. Sometimes negative emotions are important. They're useful. And the analogy I often use with my students is with, you know, physical pain, right? You know, if you stick your hand on a hot oven, you know, that's going to be painful. That feeling is telling you, you need to do something. It's telling you, you need to pull your hand away. I think the sadness, the frustration, the anxiety we're all experiencing, it's telling we have certain needs that aren't being met in the context of the pandemic. But the good news is that there are strategies that we can all use to get those needs met a little bit better.
Okay, so we're going to talk about those strategies for sure, because I want people to leave this hour with some tools. but before we do that, another thing that I've been hearing a lot from folks is as they look across the world in places, whether it's across the street from them or in another nation where there has been a lot of suffering and a lot of loss due to the pandemic, both in terms of life and or health or economic well-being, you know, they'll often say, you know, there but for the grace of God go I, right? And yet that realization doesn't necessarily lead to a sense of relief or gratitude or a little bit of well-being. It leads to a sense of guilt, and therefore I shouldn't be happy. Have you seen that, Professor Santos?
Yeah, I often hear from people who talk about, you know, because there's suffering in the world, how can I be happy, right? Whether it's about the pandemic or all the systematic injustice we're all facing, right? How can I go about being happy in my life when I know so many groups are suffering? And I think this gets to an incorrect theory that we have about happiness, that it's kind of, you know, zero sum, right? Like, you know, if I'm kind of taking the happiness away, or I should sort of feel guilty on behalf of other people's happiness. But there's a sense in that that's not how it works. In fact, the act of you taking time to take care of yourself, do these practices, which we know will boost your well-being, inevitably that's going to help other people. And it does so in two ways. One is that we know that there's evidence of what's called emotional contagion, right? If you're putting out joy, if you're putting out optimism, that's naturally going to make it easier for the people around you to catch those sort of emotions. You know, we've all been in an office where, you know, you walk into that team meeting and there's that one really upbeat, optimistic person, and you kind of catch that, right? And we've all been in the opposite, where you walk into that team meeting and there's that kind of, you know, down in the dump sort of person, and you catch that too. You know, you could seed the kind of emotion that you want to see in your community, in your family, in your society. That's the power of emotional contagion. But another thing that we know is that if we want to solve all the problems that are out there, especially in terms of injustice and so on, we need the kind of resilience to do it. And I worry that this act of not paying attention to your own well-being, you know, feeling that it's guilty to be grateful right now, or it's guilty to have your own social connection, that means you're reducing the bandwidth you have to solve those sorts of problems. And so in some sense, if you want to solve the problems that are out there, you really need to take care of yourself and take care of your own mental health and happiness. I'm going to mangle the Audre Lorde quote, but there's this idea that, you know, self-care is a political act, right? If we want to solve the bad stuff out there and make the world a better place, we need to focus on our happiness.
Jack, I'm going to come to you in a second, but let me share a little story with both of you if I can, because sometimes I debate within my own mind whether happiness is something that needs to be worked for, to pursue, to put it in a very American context, or if it's also just a sort of a natural state of humanity, of humankind. And the reason why I wonder about that is because many, many years ago on a family visit to India, my mom took me to visit one of her relatives. And, you know, my family grew up in pretty impoverished circumstances in India. And I remember visiting this relative. She was about 80-something. And she lived in a tiny one-bedroom, not even one-bedroom flat, one-room flat. Okay, there was a bed in the corner and one hot plate. And they had a shared bathroom with other members of in the building. And she was 80 years old. And more than 80. And when we walked in, you know, to my eyes, I saw a situation of poverty, right? Of want. But this sort of aunt several times removed from me, she saw us, saw my mom, and just like jumped up and down with happiness. And like the whole time we were there, she was happy. And I asked my mom later, like, is she always like this? And my mom said, yes. That like no matter how hard life has been, like this particular woman just was happy. So is it a natural state of being, Lori?
Yeah, well, I think it's both, right? It's potentially a natural state of being, but it takes some work. You know, it takes more work for some of us than others. You know, there is evidence for what might be considered a heritable part of our well-being, right? So it's just easier for some people than others. But that heritable component is pretty tiny. It turns out that it's a lot more our behaviors. You know, my guess is that that family member that you're talking about, you know, she probably was naturally the kind of person who was grateful, you know, even in the face of bad circumstances. She was probably the kind of person who naturally was really social, you know, given how she reacted when your family showed up, right? And those are behaviors and mindsets that we can engage in that are a path towards happiness. So I actually think that pursuit of happiness, you know, not to like, you know, like really like their forefathers were wrong a lot about a lot of things, but this was something that they got right. You know, their happiness takes work, you know, for good and for bad. We can achieve it, but we got to put in the right strategies.
Okay. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Well, Jack, this brings us to, I think, actually really talking a little bit about the American context of how we view happiness here. What about the pursuit of happiness, Jack?
Well, you know, the scholars note that the phrase life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, life and liberty come from John Locke. And he, who, of course, had a great influence on the founders, but he made it life, liberty, and property. Jefferson dropped out property and substituted the pursuit of happiness. Why did he drop out property? Well, one of his biographers, Joseph Ellis, conjectures that he, quote, was implicitly denying that owning slaves was an unalienable right protected by the founding document. He wrote the declaration on a portable desk made by a former slave. And, of course, he owned slaves. But in Ellis's reading, he couldn't have protection of property like that in the founding document. So he substituted the pursuit of happiness, which had an 18th century meaning different from ours today. It meant much more like social happiness. It was mixed with virtue, with public morality, with courage and justice and so on. And one of the ironies of the American situation, it seems to me, is that we have lived the pursuit of happiness not in the 18th century sense, the social happiness, but rather in the property sense. Locke won out, didn't he? I mean, where the pursuit of happiness for so many of us, it's the leitmotif of a consumer society. So Locke got in the last word with property.
Fascinating. Well, so Professor Santos, then, I mean, I'm intrigued by Jack's pointing out of the sort of the modern view of what the pursuit of happiness is in the United States. I do wonder if the very idea that happiness is something to be pursued in this country sets us up for it to be very individualistic pursuit. And therefore, when people don't attain it or feel as if they have reached some sort of stage in life or ability in life or even those momentary experiences of happiness, that somehow they as individuals are doing something wrong.
Yeah, I think, you know, you're making a couple of great points here. You know, one is this idea that happiness comes from these individualized pursuits. You know, it comes from, you know, getting a new car, my own individual, you know, achievements. You know, I see this in my students, like they have to get perfect grades, right, to be happy. But these are all misconceptions about the kinds of things that are going to work for making us happy. And this is one of the things I start by teaching my students, right? We have all these misconceptions about what happiness is. And one of them is that it's individual. In fact, if you look at every available study of happy people, what you find is that happy people aren't selfish. They aren't individualist. They are very social. They spend time with the people they care about. They're around people more often. And they're often doing nice things for other people. Controlled for income, happier people donate more money to charity, right? Happy people spend more time on others. They get their happiness not through these individualized pursuits, but through kind of more collective, more social pursuits. So I think that's one of them. But I think, you know, another problem with the Americanized ideal of happiness is that it doesn't allow for negative emotions. It doesn't allow for suffering. It doesn't allow for the full range of human experience. You know, and this was something, you know, I think, you know, the forefathers were getting at, but it's also something that scholars have thought for a long time. You know, if you look back at Aristotelian notions of happiness, you see this concept of eudaimonia, where happiness is really more about flourishing, flourishing in a rich sort of moral sense. So I think we get off track. We have these rich misconceptions about what happiness is. And that's a problem because when we're trying to pursue it, you know, we're putting work in, but we're putting work into the wrong stuff.
Oh, that's so interesting. Okay, so we're headed towards a break here. We're getting a lot of comments online. For example, Stephanie says, the discussion of happiness brings up something my husband and I used to discuss. There were many times I was content, but that may not include happy, being peaceful in a moment, but not an overwhelming other type of reaction. And Margot says, at this point, most days I don't even say I'm okay in reply to general inquiries. It's more like I'm eating three times a day most days and I'm not in danger of hurting myself or anyone else. And David Henry says, I prefer contentment to happiness. So Jack Beatty and Lori Santos, we'll talk about things to do to maybe get closer to touching that happiness more often when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about why, even as the world hurls so many reasons for you to not be happy, or you think it does, why you deserve to be happy. And Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst, joins us, and Lori Santos is with us. She's a cognitive scientist and professor of psychology at Yale and host of the terrific podcast, The Happiness Lab. And before we sort of settle into talking about solutions or ways to actually touch more of that happiness more often. Jack, you brought that Cheever story to us before, and I'd love it if you inspired us with a little bit more of examples of happiness from literature.
Sure. You know, it seems to me that one of the sort of one of the events of happiness is that it's a gift, a something that happens to you, and that at its best, at its richest, it releases you from yourself. You go on a kind of furlough from your self-criticism and self-reproach and guilt, and you're delivered into the moment. Wordsworth wrote a great poem about this called Resolution and Independence. And it's a young poet walking on the moor, happy, spring, but then suddenly a dark thoughts flood in upon him. And he feels, he writes, we poets in our youth begin in gladness, but thereof come in the end despondency and madness. Now, whether it were by peculiar grace, a leading from above, a something given, yet it befell that in this lonely place, when I with these untoward thoughts had striven, beside a pool bare to the eye of heaven, I saw a man before me unawares, the oldest man he seemed that ever wore gray hairs. And they engage in a colloquy, they talk and so on, back and forth. And the poet said, "Perplexed and longing to be comforted, my question eagerly did I renew. How is it that you live? And what is it you do?" He with a smile did then his words repeat, and said that, gathering leeches, far and wide he traveled, stirring thus about his feet the waters of the pools where they abide. "Once I could meet with them on every side, but they have dwindled long by slow decay. Yet still I persevere and find them where I may." And soon with this he other matter blended, cheerfully uttered, with demeanor kind, but stately in the main. And when he ended, I could have laughed myself to scorn to find in that decrepit man so firm a mind. "God," said I, "be my help and stay secure. I'll think of the leech-gatherer on the lonely moor." He's delivered from himself simply by meeting this man in such wretched circumstances, who yet, in a way like your aunt, triumphs over them with his attitude toward life.
Wow. Well, Professor Santos, you know what I hear in that poem is something that Jack said about just being willing to drop the self-reproach, the self-criticism. Is that one of the sort of mental tools to achieving greater happiness or joy?
Definitely. I mean, we forget that the chatter inside our head matters, right? You know, the fact that we talk to ourselves like an awful drill sergeant, it probably doesn't feel good, you know, but the striking thing is it also doesn't do what we think. You know, I think sometimes we think we need to talk to ourselves in this mean way, you know, like get it together, you know, eat healthier, whatever it is. But in practice, that drill sergeant voice makes us more likely to procrastinate. It makes us less likely to achieve our goals. There's lots of evidence, for example, from the psychologist Kristen Neff, that there's much more power and what she calls self-compassion, this idea of being a little bit mindful, right? Like paying attention to your emotions, you know, noticing that you're just human, you know, you're part of common humanity, and then just being kind to yourself. You know, we sometimes forget that our worst critic is sometimes ourselves in our own heads. We say stuff to ourselves that we'd never say to a close friend, but we think it's okay to do to ourselves.
Oh, wow. You know, you're striking at the heart of my own insecurities here, Professor Santos, because suddenly it occurred to me that my colleagues who were here in the office with me, they'll frequently hear me when I'm in front of the computer saying, "Work faster, Meghna. Be better. Get this done in a higher, in a better way." Like, I literally say it out loud because I'm wearing headphones, right? So I don't know. I forget that other people are listening. So I am hearing and listening to what you're saying very closely, Professor Santos. But let's get sort of another reality check from another On Point listener here. Tony Keefe is with us. Tony's from Marysville, Washington. And Tony, are you there?
I am here.
Hi. So are you happy?
Yes.
I love hearing that. Okay. How do you define your happiness? How do you experience it?
It's a conscious decision. I call it kind of my actitude. You know, I act upon it. When I was 60, my 60th birthday, I had to pull the side of the road and cry. And I realized I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up, because I had dedicated my life since childhood to everybody else. And I decided that I wasn't going to be like that anymore, and I smiled and cried. And it took about a week of smiling and crying, and then I smiled for real. And it continues. You know, it hasn't been easy. I'm what is called one of the rare exceptions. I'm an extroverted author now. Because I retired and found a passion and got busy on it. But with the pandemic, I was just kind of crushed with no interaction. So I started walking, and I go walk every day picking up garbage and saying hello to the homeless. And now I'm starting to get honked at and thank-you'd from the street, because it was just action, you know, taking action, something positive, reaching out of myself.
Can you tell me a little bit more about what triggered that moment? I mean, I can still see you in my mind's eye pulling over to the side of the road, and it almost sounds like you had something of an epiphany or a revelation.
It really was. When I was little, I met an aunt, my Aunt Hilma, and she was elderly and wrinkled, and she's the most beautiful woman I ever saw because all of her wrinkles went up. you know, from smiles. And I decided then I was going to work on it, but that was as a little kid. And then when it all came crashing in on me at turning 60, and I'm an insurance investigator where, you know, you get no good news, and, you know, all these things just came at me at once, I just made changes. And I reach out. You know, I've been listening to the program, and I'm so excited about it because it's like I do reach out. I do things for others. I donate for trees every month, you know, just to make the world better.
Well, Tony from Marysville, Washington, thank you so much for sharing that attitude. I really appreciate it, Tony. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Professor Santos, what do you hear? I mean, in Tony's case, it was this sort of almost moment of, like, almost the proverbial bolt from the sky, it sounds like. But she's grounding her happiness in the consistent taking of actions, as she said.
Yeah, I love this idea of actitude, Tony. I'm totally going to steal this. But, you know, just in her answer, I hear so many of the tips that science shows that we need to do to be happier, right? One is doing for others, right? She's out there picking up garbage, you know, talking to the homeless and so on. Another is just social connection, right? You know, that every available study of happy people shows that happy people are more social. And Tony's getting it by, you know, talking, you know, to homeless individuals, to talking to the people on the street who are honking at her. She's also doing things that are meaningfully good, right? You know, even when she can't kind of do much else, she's out there picking up garbage, right? Something for a bigger cause. You know, and finally, just the simple things. I'm hearing a lot of healthy habits in there, just like exercising, right? Like moving your body. You know, there's evidence that a half hour of cardio a day can be as effective as a prescription of an antidepressant medication for reducing symptoms of depression, right? And so all of these things are actions we can take, right? Simple actions we can take to improve our well-being. And what we find with my students is that, you know, as people do these kinds of things, I give my students these things for homework, right? They have to exercise more, or they have to get out and do random acts of kindness or talk to people. And what you find is after a semester of doing that, students will self-report being, you know, not a lot, but a little bit happier on a happiness scale. You see these significant effects by taking action. Just like these.
You know, this is the time, though, where I'm going to drag in my predilection for melancholy reality check, okay? Because I can feel, and I know that for many, many people in the United States, finding the time and the wherewithal to take those actions is extremely difficult, right? Happiness feels like something of an ephemeral goal, but in order to reach that ephemera, we have to be able to satisfy and meet material needs first, right? And when there's so much uncertainty, housing uncertainty, food uncertainty, job uncertainty, health uncertainty, political uncertainty now, the materiality of American life does not lend itself to being able to do those other things that you were talking about, Professor Santos, to achieve the ephemeral joy that should come with happiness. So what do we do about that?
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree, right? I mean, this is one of the reasons that for a relatively overall wealthy nation, a very unequal wealthy, but a wealthy nation, the U.S. isn't as happy as other, you know, equally wealthy nations, right? We have a lot of cultural structures that don't necessarily promote any of the kinds of activities that we were just talking about. That said, you know, what the research really shows is that these things don't have to take a lot of time, right? A random act of kindness could be texting a friend to check in, right? A social connection could be just like, you know, talking to the person at the grocery store when you go pick up food, right? You know, this act of doing something nice for others could be holding a door open, right? You know, this simple act of being present or exercising could be, you know, parking your car a little bit further when you walk, you know, into the grocery store. Like, these are all tiny, tiny things that don't take a lot of time. I mean, I think this is another misconception. We think the pursuit of happiness needs to be this grand pursuit, right? We have to take all this time to do it. But all these activities are 5 minutes here, 3 minutes here and there, right? They're things that even in the busiest, time-famished of lives, you can squeeze in.
Well, I want to offer another take on, in fact, almost our duty to be joyful. And this comes from former U.S. Poet Laureate Tracy K. Smith, because recently she reimagined the original text used in Beethoven's Ode to Joy. It was part of the Global Ode to Joy Project. And she read this reimagining at Carnegie Hall in New York in November of 2020, in the depths of late fall and the pandemic, and here's an excerpt.
Joy, like water, milk of mothers, kind and wicked, all deserve joy's compassion, freely given, joy which can't be sold or earned. In the depths of blackest soil, in the lightless atmosphere, in the atom and the ether, animating all that is. Let us feel it. Let us heed it. Let us seek its deepest kiss. Let us live our brief lives mining that which joy alone can give.
Former U.S. Poet Laureate Tracy K. Smith in November of 2020. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. Jack, we just got a little bit of time left, but I'm feeling the rising tide of inspiration here. So tell us, what was one of the happiest moments in your life?
Well, it was I began with baseball. I'll end with baseball. It was a baseball game I went to with my son and a friend. He was, I guess, in their early 20s. We had a box seat. Someone had given us the tickets, maybe 10 rows up. And during the game, a scene had unfolded at the verge of the you know, where the field met the seats. The bat boy would come over and toss a ball, and boys would gather in the corridor and grab the ball. Each time, the boys would put up their hand, and another boy would get it. And behind, a little girl would return alone to her mother's knee without a ball. So something happened. I wasn't paying attention, and overcame the bat boy late in the game. My son stood up, and he signaled the bat boy. The bat boy threw the ball up. My son caught it. He said, "Excuse me." And he walked down the aisle and placed that ball in the girl's hand. That was the happiest moment I can remember in my life, because it was all that we've been talking about. It was a gift. It was something that came out of the blue. It was, and it was that moment of generosity. He saw what was happening. I saw the little girl being neglected. It didn't occur to me to talk to the bat boy, but he did that because, well, that's who he was.
Yeah. Well, Jack Beattie, On Point News Analyst, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Dr. Santos, Professor Santos, we've only got about 30 seconds left here. If you were to tell people listening one thing that they can do when this radio program ends for today in order to remember that they deserve happiness and to act on it, what would it be?
It's just to remember that happiness is under your control, right? You know, text a friend, notice how it makes you feel. Take 3 deep breaths, notice how it makes you feel. Have a nice chat with someone on the street, notice how it makes you feel. These things are under our control.
Well, Lori Santos is a professor of psychology at Yale and host of the podcast, The Happiness Lab. Professor Santos, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, as a last thought today, I'd love to share with you one of my favorite short stories of all time. It's by E.B. White. He wrote it in 1947. It's called Second Tree from the Corner. And it's about a man named Trexler who visits a psychiatrist in New York. He's got some sort of free-floating anxieties that he can't quite pin down why. And then, at the end of the story, really, he does have this epiphany. And it's just one of my favorite paragraphs and inspires me a lot when I return to it. So here it is. This is what E.B. White writes. Trexler felt invigorated. Suddenly, his sickness seemed health, his dizziness stability. A small tree rising between him and the light stood there, saturated with the evening, each gilt-edged leaf perfectly drunk with excellence and delicacy. Trexler's spine registered an ever so slight tremor as it picked up this natural disturbance in the lovely scene. "I want the second tree from the corner, just as it stands," he said, answering an imaginary question from an imaginary physician. And he felt a slow pride in realizing that what he wanted, none could bestow, and that what he had, none could take away. He felt content to be sick, unembarrassed at being afraid, and in the jungle of his fear he glimpsed, as he had so often glimpsed them before, the flashy tail feathers of the bird courage. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.